So the Director of Public Prosecutions has told the Justice Committee that he is revising the Code for Crown Prosecutors to insert wording requiring prosecutors to, quote, be mindful of potential bias in decision-making, close quote. The CPS has said that the aim is to eliminate racial bias. Now, the problem is that the public will hear something quite different. And what the public will hear is that somehow ethnic minority individuals will be treated differently by the justice system and therefore will be more advantaged by the justice system than white people. So where do I even begin to try and disabuse the public and everyone else of that notion? So black and ethnic minority people are overwhelmingly, by a factor of 200 or 300%, more likely to be criminalized and likewise to be sentenced for very, very long sentences compared to the average white person. There is systemic racist bias against ethnic minority individuals within the criminal justice system at almost every level, starting in childhood, the likelihood of arrest of a black young person compared to a white young person. And let's be hypothetical. Let's say a black young person in Hackney versus a white young person in a rural village in Wiltshire. The chance of that black young person being arrested or coming to the attention of police are about probably 2,000% higher from that white person in the rural environment. So there is systemic bias against black and ethnic minority communities.
But Chris, aren't you comparing chalk with cheese? Because of course that young white person in a rural environment, let's say in Wiltshire or Hampshire, may not come into contact with background criminality. It's not in an urban environment. The kinds of pressures that young people are under in those communities are not the same as the kind of pressures young people are under, say, in Hackney. And as a result of that, the young person in Hackney is more likely to be exposed to criminality, even if he or she is not criminally minded.
You're right. And that's another reason why the over-criminalisation of ethnic minority communities takes place, because of the fact that those communities are exposed to the often city-centred systemic issues around the drug trade and gang violence and gang affiliation, which doesn't exist to the same extent and with the same deadly consequences in rural areas. But that's not a like-for-like comparison. Let me ask you this question in response. In a Wiltshire village, do you think the young lads don't smoke cannabis? Or do you think that somehow nobody smokes cannabis at all in these rural villages? Because I'd love to know how many young white people in rural villages are arrested for smoking or possessing cannabis. I imagine the number is close to zero.
Well, let me bring Jose Pina Sanchez back into this, Professor of Quantitative Criminology at the University of Leeds. How would you respond to the kind of comparisons that Chris is making there? And how would you account for the disparities in charging rates, in investigations, in treatment as children or indeed adults by the police and then later down the line, the criminal justice system?
So I think Chris has made an important point here, which is he's highlighted the cumulative effect of the bias that occurs at different stages of the criminal justice system. And when you put it all together, really, it gives you that those kind of like really shocking figures that, you know, like should prompt us to respond to this problem somehow. However, my view is that we need to be focused as to, you know, where exactly those disparities are coming from and then respond to the evidence that we have in front of us, right? So if we're thinking about, you know, what the CPS can do, the CPS shouldn't be overriding or, you know, like kind of like trying to counter all the bias that is taking place in the criminal justice system. It should be actually dealing with the bias that they've identified in their own decision-making process. That would be my view. Because I think, you know, like a tailored approach is really what is necessary really to deal with this problem. Otherwise, you end up with potential unintended consequences and not really dealing with the problem. That's not to say that I agree with Chris. You know, the problem is monumental, it's huge, and we need to act upon it.
So, Jose, what do you think has been done thus far to address this disparity in sentencing, to try and deal with this culture? Because, I mean, I've been in journalism for about 35 years. People have been talking about this for as long as I've been in this industry.
Yeah, no, okay, that sentencing is a perfect example. It's one that I know pretty well, really, and where I think they've done clear progress. Like, they've managed to achieve real progress. So in sentencing, we've got indirect evidence that, you know, like one of the key solutions or one of the key, you know, like interventions that the Sentencing Council put in place has actually managed to reduce the degree of disparities. So, for example, I'm referring to the sentencing guidelines, and in particular, they detected strong disparities amongst drug offenders So they introduce reminders for judges when they are sentencing, those kind of cases, to be mindful of those disparities that have been detected and documented. Not only that, but they've also identified specific factors where disparities tend to be more prevalent, certain mitigating factors like, to do with adultification bias or to do with potential for rehabilitation. And even though there hasn't been a scientific evaluation of the impact of those interventions, what we can see is that the extent of the disparities from before they had those reminders in the guidelines was a lot larger than after, a few years after. And I take that as indirect evidence that there are things that we can do to improve the system, which don't involve like a blanket approach, involve, looking at the causes of where the disparities are coming from.
Thank you for that. Chris, I see that Stephen Parkinson, the head of the CPS, admits that his staff felt affronted when it was suggested that they were biased in their decision making, but he says he's going to pursue a revision of the code. The question is, how should it be further revised?
Well, I think the problem for me is that what he's trying to do is place responsibility for all of these things. And by the way, I should say that the last contribution I just heard, I agree with every word. I totally and wholly agree with what's just been set out for you. But in relation to this, I think that, as I say, the problem is how does a prosecutor in Hull or Cornwall or Newcastle sitting down looking at a file that has an eyewitness statement that says that a person broke into a house, some DNA evidence, there's pretty clear evidence they committed a burglary, let's say. How does that prosecutor deal with this advice? What do they do? One suspect is black, the evidence is the same. One suspect is white, the evidence is the same. What's the prosecutor supposed to do with the guidance that they've been given? And the answer is they can't possibly start it from that micro decision, which is supposed to be made on entirely neutral legal grounds, somehow superimpose the entire sort of systemic racial bias that's existed, as you've observed, not just for the last 35 years, but let's be frank, since time began. And they can't possibly reflect that in the decision as to whether to prosecute one person who clearly, on the evidence, broke into someone's house and stole their computer, and someone who's of a different race who did the same thing. Because it's ridiculous. Of course, young black people are much more likely, because of other huge systemic issues, to be in communities where there are higher crime rates and therefore where there are higher levels of police supervision and police detection. But the bottom line is this: what we need is a massive national kind of conversation about race, about all of these issues that have divided our societies and led to the divisive society we now live in. In a world where people either kind of embrace being English in particular, or are prepared to embrace everyone, and that's somehow a binary choice. Anyway,
Right.
food for thought.
Food for thought, indeed. Jose, are you prepared to eat the food for thought that Chris has given you? And if you are, how would you go forward, given what you know about quantitative criminology, and how would one sell it to a British public that has been almost groomed to believe that all of the biases that used to make things very difficult for black and brown people have gone, and it's now making things difficult for white people, especially when it comes to criminal justice?
I think Chris was right to say that, if the advice is too broad, is ineffective, really. It's like, what is the prosecutor going to do there? And it's not just that it's ineffective. If it's vague, the advice could be easily, interpreted by anyone who wants to use that as an example of two-tier justice against, white British. So it will likely, backfire and lead to, like fuel or promote this sense of grievance that we see. So I would definitely not advise doing that. My view would be, let's try to dig down exactly, understand what are the causes, of the disparity or the biases that we are seeing, and try to act upon them. So for the case of sentencing, reminders on the specific factors where we see that are misapplied or applied disproportionately and potentially pointing at, evidence of bias. So, for example, mitigating factors of whether the offender shows remorse or whether the offender shows good character or potential for rehabilitation. Those are certain factors that we've seen that are probably, like leading to the disparities that we see. So I would recommend acting upon those, and specifically on the stages where we've seen that they creep in. So, for example, we're talking about Crown Prosecution Service as CPS, right, at charge decisions. In there, they've identified this joint enterprise factor being misapplied for different defendants from different individuals from different ethnic groups. And in sentencing, we've identified these other mitigating factors. But there are certain stages of the criminal justice system where we don't observe any disparities, like decisions of parole is one example. To sum up, what I would suggest is like a scientific, highly tailored approach that identifies the specific sources of those disparities and acts upon them, rather than a blanket approach, as it was attempted last year, I think, by the Sentencing Council, requiring that everyone, every ethnic minority offender, would need to have a pre-sentence report. I think that really backfired and potentially fueled some of the sense of grievance that we see nowadays and the whole conspiracy theory about two-tier justice against white British.
Right. And let's finish on the front line, Chris Dorr. You'll have seen the quote from Sir Stephen Watson, the Chief Constable of Greater Manchester, and he gave a recent interview and he warned that policing in Britain had adopted the, quote, language of activism and that official guidance had overcorrected to combat accusations of racism. What about that? Because, of course, you've got the decision that a prosecutor has to make, but you've also got the discretion that a police officer has in how they approach people on the streets.
Yeah, I agree. And I think we've gone to the position now where there are many in positions where, of discretion of the kind that you describe, particularly in policing, where they are told one thing one minute, one thing the next. They're given vague guidance, and then that guidance is changed every 5 minutes at the drop of a hat. And I think police officers, and I know many police officers, have acted for every rank of the police service in my 33 years as a lawyer, up to and including chief constable. And I can tell you that every rank of policing feels that they're battered from left to right and all over the place, and individual officers on the ground have no idea how they're supposed to deal with, situations where they're being accused of being racist or accused of something involving sexism or some other thing. And how are they supposed to navigate that? And, that's dangerous. That is dangerous on the streets, because police officers, whether they're black, white, or of any particular, ethnicity, whichever the police officers, they all need to have exactly the same status on the streets and the same level of respect on the streets for all of the people in their communities, no matter what their backgrounds. And so if we're in a situation where police officers are actually afraid and may potentially go easy on people in situations where that creates risk because they're worried of being accused of being racist, that's something that requires a grown-up national conversation. And I really wish that national politicians would have a grown-up conversation about how we make these things less divisive and how we move forward rather than become more divisive, more angry, and basically leave our police officers feeling that they are lost and have no way of knowing what they're supposed to do every day.